Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
Hello, everyone. I'm Beth Harris, filling in for Dan Hochheiser on Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser. I'm usually a regular guest about halfway through the show, but today I get to ask the questions. Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser explores a variety of issues in the justice system, and you can have a look at past shows on Facebook. The page is called Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser. No surprise there. Now, for those of you who don't know me, I'm an attorney in New York State. I was with Robert Morgenthau as an assistant district attorney for 8 years, and after practicing law, I went into television. At the time, O.J. Simpson got arrested for murder, and I was with Court TV and HLN for almost 20 years. About 6 months ago, I launched a subscription website, which is called carisoncrime.com. Check it out. I blog about trials, I post court documents and videos of my legal analysis and answers to your questions. Now, a regular segment of this show is a question of the day. And because today's topic is one of my favorites, forensics in the courtroom, I chose a question related to it. Now, my question is based upon the Innocence Project's first 325 exonerations. So here's the question. What percentage of wrongful convictions of those first 325 were the result of faulty, erroneous forensics? This is multiple choice. 23%, 47%, or 72%? I'll give you the answer later in the show. So I've mentioned the topic today, forensics in the courtroom. It's the intersection of science and law, and it is fraught with problems. Though defendants are convicted every day based on scientific evidence and experts' interpretation of that evidence. We need the science. It's very useful, but grave and even fatal mistakes have been made. So to talk about it, I am so happy to welcome one of the best in the legal field. His name is Marvin Schechter. He's a New York criminal defense attorney. He's been practicing law for over 40 years, so he is a veteran. And I wanted to talk to him today because he is a co-author of a 2009 report called Strengthening Forensic Science in the United States, A Path Forward. Now, I bought that report. It's really a hardcover book in 2009 because I was curious about why it was necessary to write it. And now I want to know what's happened since its publication, what changes have been made. Now, Mr. Schechter was a co-chair of the formation of the National College of Forensic Science, a joint effort of the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys and Cardozo Law School, dedicated to training attorneys across the U.S. He regularly lectures to attorneys about forensics. He's also a member of the New York State Commission on Forensic Science. And before he starts talking, because I don't want to use up any more of his time, I want to add that any opinions Marvin Schechter expresses are solely his own and not those of any public commission or bar association with which he is associate. Thank you for joining me, Mr. Schechter.
Good morning.
So why the need for this report 6 years ago? What was the point of it?
Well, the context that caused the publication of the report was severalfold. One, there had been a large number of wrongful convictions that had come to light, and they were not decreasing, but increasing. Many of these wrongful convictions were based upon faulty forensic science, either mistakes made in the science, sciences that really did not exist or were not validated, embellished testimony. So that was one problem. The second problem was an increasing number of highly publicized laboratory scandals where things were going wrong in labs across the United States. They were uncovering various mistakes, errors, sometimes acts of commission, and these were getting way out of hand. As a result, the Congress of the United States, concerned about what was happening, commission the National Academies of Science, which is part of the National Research Council, to do a report, a broad overview of what was going on in forensic science, what the problems were, how they should be addressed, and what recommendations, if any, could be advanced that would improve the situation. That's what resulted in the February 2009 publication of the report you've alluded to.
Now, I know the Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings a couple of times, but, I mean, you're talking about labs, forensic science. There are so many different areas. The task ahead of you was daunting, and I'm sure it continues to be. I mean, what areas are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about everything. Let's start with the basics, and the one that is, of course, the most surprising to everybody, which is that many of these forensic sciences, well known to the public, we found had never been properly scientifically validated using the methods and protocols, standards and procedures of normal science. So we're talking about things like hair analysis, fiber analysis, handwriting, paints and coatings, explosives, arson investigations, blood spatter analysis, human bite marks, and then, of course, also tool marks, which the public knows popularly as ballistics. Its proper term is tool marks. We found that all of these things had never, ever been scientifically validated, and this was a huge, big problem. We found.
Well, what does that mean?
It means that in science, when you develop a science, you also develop tests, scientific, rigorously controlled tests, to determine whether or not what you're doing can be replicated over and over with a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. That's a hallmark of all science. If you're doing stem cell research, if you're doing cancer research, if you're doing any kind of scientific research, labs develop these tests internally and sometimes externally by going to outsiders who have a fresh eye, an unbiased eye, to develop tests to say, you know something? We've subjected this science to tests, and we find that it really works. So an obvious one, blood chemical analysis to determine alcohol in the blood system. That has been rigorously tested and found to be an absolute science. DNA, very popular. That was rigorously tested and was found to be a valid science. But many of these other sciences, which I just spoke about, had never undergone that kind of testing. That was a huge problem. We also found that in the forensic world, that the usual standards applied in scientific testing or scientific labs were not being applied in forensic testing. So, for example, you have in regular science something known as the error rate or measurement of error. This is more popularly explained by saying when you listen to a poll on the daily news in the evening and the newscaster says the poll is off by plus or minus 4 percentage points. There's a similar way to do this with scientific testing so that you test for your error of measurement. And what that simply means is that you try to figure out how much the tolerances are off so that the final result that you get, you can say with some reasonable degree of scientific certainty, has been properly tested, and the error, whatever it is so negligible that we can say with certainty this is a good result. We found that not in existence in many cases in many of these scientific disciplines. Bias, huge problem in science, and one that science does very well in dealing with. What do we mean by bias?
Let me just stop you there and remind our listeners, Mr. Schechter, I'm Beth Karras filling in for Dan Hochheiser on Talkin' Law, and we're talking to Marvin Schechter, criminal defense attorney in New York City, about forensic science. He's an expert. The issues surrounding evidence presented at trials where mistakes are made and where there's certainly room for improvement. So back to the point you were just making, Mr. Schechter, about bias. That
right.
concerns me. I mean,
Huge problem. Huge problem. Because bias is not something, by the way, that's venal. It's not something where somebody, you think of somebody sitting in a lab saying, I'm going to go get somebody. I'm going to hurt them. It's not how it works. Bias is an unconscious wiring system that all of us have as human beings. It's part of the human nervous system. And bias needs to be accounted for. So in regular science, this is accounted for, first, by becoming aware of it, two, testing for it, and three, replicating experiments looking at the issue of bias to see if it crept in to how the study was done, the experiments were done, and how the conclusions were reached. We found in the 2009 publication of the report that bias had rarely, if ever, been studied with respect to any of the forensic sciences. And that was a very, very troubling finding, because the other big finding that we made, which was well known in the forensic science community, but it never really permeated the courtroom, was that a great many of these so-called sciences were really subjective in nature. What do I mean by that? X sits down and looks at two fingerprints, a known fingerprint and a fingerprint recovered at the scene. Using on-the-job training, courses that have been taken, in the end, what fingerprints came down to, what tool marks came down to, was an individual examiner taking a look at the evidence and subjectively determining whether or not there was a match between the evidence found at the crime scene and the known evidence attributed to the defendant. That's very
okay,
bad.
So
because
there,
if
there
everything
is
subjective, bias can creep in, and that's a huge problem.
Absolutely. So I was going to ask you whether or not it's really a science, or is it more of an art, this interpretation of fingerprints or tool marks, for example. I mean, is it really a science?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. It's a great question. And in the end, I think the conclusion we reached was that for many of these disciplines, they're not sciences at all. What they really are disciplines. In other words, they involve scientific principles. So, for example, fingerprints. Fingerprints involves biology. We know from biology that there's human skin. We know there are indentations in the skin. We know that the skin has pores and oil comes out of them that can leave a fingerprint behind. But what we don't know is whether or not two fingerprints can actually, or a fingerprint, is actually the only fingerprint of its kind in the universe, which is an assertion that has been made since the beginning of time, but never been
right.
tested.
Right, I was going to say, we've all been told that our fingerprints are unique.
Right, never been tested. And I'll tell you something else that came up in the course of the 2009 report. A researcher on the West Coast posited this question. What about a partial fingerprint? What if part of a fingerprint is recovered at the scene? Is that partial fingerprint unique in the entire universe? Or is there other partial fingerprints that could be the same? Again, we haven't tested that. And the research on that is began sometime after 2009 and continues to this day. And the same held true for tool marks, how tool marks actually work. The courts have actually begun to address tool marks. Great case in a federal court several years ago, I think in 2009, 2010, in Maryland, United States versus Malzone, where a judge did an exhaustive analysis of tool mark testing and concluded, you know, this is really a subjective analysis, and that the so-called standards that have been set forth really have not been subjected to validation. They really don't tell us whether or not the subjective comparison by an individual examiner is correct or not.
Well, I have to tell you, this just turns everything upside down that we've kind of taken for granted. When I was trying cases and putting in this kind of evidence and laying the foundation for the introduction, and it went virtually unchallenged, sometimes it was stipulated to by the defense, I mean, it really turns everything on its head. How was your report received, and what's happened in the last 6 years?
Well, the first question, how was it received? The answer is not well. The second question is, what's happened in the last 6 years? Answer, not much. Let's address the first question. The report was very controversial, even though it really had not much in it that was very new. Most of it was well known, but had never really been compiled and put together in one place with the assertions that we made. The forensic science community was very uneven in its approach, but I would say, and this is my opinion, that it was not well received. There was a lot of conferences that were held. The American Academy of Forensic Sciences devoted a lot of time and space to this. Various bar associations had forensic people come in and address audiences, but in the end, it was very badly received. The prosecutors were pretty much outraged across the country. In fact, the early response by most prosecutors was the report was nothing more than gibberish. It was simply a policy report. It was wrong. It did not properly look at the sciences, et cetera. And that, by the way, has continued to this day. The prosecutorial reaction to this report and to changes and improvements in forensic science continues to be very, very poor. So what happened was the first persons who really took a look at this were Congress. After all, they commissioned the report. The Senate Judiciary Committee began to do a lot of research. There were hearings. And there's a lot of meetings with all the stakeholders with the Senate Judiciary Committee. The end result was a bill that was put forward and went absolutely nowhere. There was no real support for it. It never really grabbed the Congress's attention, and that remains so to this day. With that kind of stagnation, Senator Rockefeller, I think out of West Virginia, or Virginia, I'm not sure, he started hearings in his committee. He had a separate committee of Congress, and he pushed for research. One of the conclusions of the NAS report was that we were sorely lacking in research into these disciplines, and that needed to be done. So he started to push for that. That also has gone absolutely nowhere, and of course the senator is no longer in the Senate. So it has not been good. The only place where there was some advancement was in the courts. And between 2009 and 2015, judges began to really start looking at the forensic disciplines. And two or three things happened. First,
but let me, before you make those points, let me just remind our listeners, I'm Beth Karras filling in for Dan Hochheiser on Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser, and we're talking to Marvin Schechter, criminal defense attorney, about forensic science, the issues surrounding evidence presented at trials, and he's enlightening us to lots of problems with various disciplines and areas of science. Continue, Mr. Schechter, about what at least federal courts have been doing.
So in the federal courts, where the judges have a lot of resources and have the time to consider these issues, the judges began to decide cases where they really looked hard at the admissibility of the forensic disciplines. And the judges went in several different ways. First, some judges continued to say, there's nothing wrong with fingerprints, there's nothing wrong with tool marks, I find that they're perfectly acceptable, and those were let in. Then there were a series of judges who said, I have big problems with these sciences and with how they operate. And these judges broke into several subcategories. Some judges said, you know, I'm going to let the science in. The technician can say that this is a science, but I find that in this case, the methodology and the scientific principles that were relied upon by the technician do not work. Therefore, I'm going to do the following. One, I'm excluding the testimony. So there were some cases it's outright excluded this evidence from coming in. This was a real change after 200 years of allowing this evidence in without question. Other judges took a different approach. They said, okay, here's what we find. One, the expert from the prosecutor's lab is an expert. Two, we find that the principles and methodology used are not proper, and therefore this evidence can come in before the jury, but with limitations. And those limitations vary from court to court in the federal system and sometimes in the state. Some judges said, I will not let the expert say what the conclusion was, that it's a match. I will not let the expert say this is a science. I will only let the expert testify as to what she did in the lab. And there were various permutations and combinations of those limitations. And that's where we are today. Either outright exclusion, allowing it in, or the limitations.
And these are federal courts.
These are mostly federal courts, yes. That's where the initial thrust for change came as a result of the 2009 NAS report. It is slowly, very, very slowly, slower than a glacier melting. It's in the states. We're just getting a lot of resistance from state court judges. It's uneven. There are some states that are great about this. Massachusetts, Colorado have real good attitude about looking into these issues and trying to inform their judges. But I would say in most of the states, it has been a very difficult road to hoe.
Can you, in the remaining minutes that we have, give an example or two of an egregious error? I don't want to give away the answer to the question of the day, the percentage of a wrongful conviction based on faulty forensics, but can you, you know, just give the listeners an example so they can sink their teeth into it, because we've been kind of talking in the abstract labs and science in general.
Well, you know, one of the worst ones we found were human bite marks. Human bite marks, basically, we found was not a science. In fact, we found there wasn't even any evidence to it. And we pretty much got that admission from those who spoke before the commission that issued the report. So in all the cases where people took the witness stand and said, this mark, this tooth mark on the victim's arm belongs to the defendant, almost all of those cases needed to be and should have been reviewed. That has not occurred yet, although there's great skepticism now in the courts about human bite marks. I'll give you more recent examples of how errors can play out and how they can be harmful. In New York City, we have an office of the chief medical examiner. We had an incident there about a few years ago where it was discovered that after 8 years, a technician had missed key stains on clothing and other objects submitted to the lab, which would have shown blood or semen stains. Either the technician missed them completely or found them in instances where there was nothing to find. Very, very bad. That went on for 8 years before it was detected. And then when the investigation into that was underway, they discovered the same technician had put on her lab bench two rape kits at the same time. That's a no-no in science. You only have one thing on your bench at a time for obvious reasons. Well, they found that in some 23-plus cases, the technician had put on her bench two rape kits at the same time, and worse, had transposed the DNA evidence from kit A to kit B and from kit B to kit A. So you had a complete bollocks in what the results were. The worst example of error and how it's led to huge problems in Massachusetts, where a technician there for endless number of years had just simply put on her desk five cases involving drug tests. She tested one vial and found drugs. So she took the results of that and put those into the other four vials on her desk. That's the simplest way I can explain it to you. And so she got results that all five had drugs recovered. This case, the Annie Ducan case, resulted in a look at, so far, I think, over 70,000 cases. It has cost the state of Massachusetts millions upon millions of dollars to correct the errors. People have been released from jail. Cases are still being looked at. You have to develop systems to figure this out, how far back to go, and who to be notified, and can you find the attorneys and the prosecutors, et cetera. Millions and millions of dollars lost to the taxpayers. And I could go on and on with those kinds of examples.
Okay, so that's misconduct by an individual. But the story of two rape kits on the table at the same time, that's an issue perhaps with the policy, the practice of the lab. That's where labs need to have the same sort of standards and practices, right?
Well, we thought we had an accreditation system. It's voluntary because we don't have mandatory accreditation throughout the United States. New York is one of the few places that requires that an outside vendor come in and accredit a lab. In the Office of Chief Medical Examiner, they were accredited in each of the 10 years that this technician was operating, and the management systems that were being used that oversaw that technician were all given a stamp of approval by the accreditation agency. The problem was that the accreditation agency either did not see or did not properly do its job or could not figure out that each year when you have a technician at the lowest level of a lab who's receiving the initial evidence from the crime scene, you have to have in place a system to double-check that person's results. Usually what most scientific labs do is they test randomly your work once a year. They pick out 10 of your cases, they look at them, and they see if you did the job correctly, and that usually works. That system was not in place in the OCME. That was a real big issue. How do you accredit a lab's management systems and overlook that a simple management policy system of randomly testing a technician's work was not in place. The other thing you need to remember is individual technicians.
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Schechter, we're actually out of time. I could talk to you for hours, and I hope that we can do this again. I really
wish
we had more time
talking
to talk. But good luck with your work. Next up, I'll be talking to a forensic scientist, a professor of forensic science, and the chairman of the Department of Sciences at John Jay College of Criminal Justice here in New York City. He also works on cases, and he testifies. Dr. Lawrence Kobolinski will be joining me.
Hockeiser & Hockeiser LLP is a highly experienced criminal defense firm that is dedicated to providing the residents of New York City with the aggressive representation that they deserve. With more than a half century of experience combined, both Lawrence and Daniel Hockeiser are well equipped to handle the most difficult of criminal cases. They also represent clients in both state and federal courts. You can rest assured that your case is in good hands when you enlist the help of the firm. For more information, contact Hockeiser & Hockeiser at Hockeiser.com, HockeiserHeiser.com, or 212-689-4343. 212-689-4343.
Welcome back to Talkin' Law with Dan Hockeiser. I'm Beth Karras, filling in for Dan today. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Lawrence Kobolinski, a familiar name to folks who follow true crime stories. He's a frequent guest not just on the radio but on cable and broadcast television shows. Dr. Kobolinski is a professor of forensic science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and chair of its Department of Sciences, and he's also one of the busiest men I know. Welcome, Dr. Kobolinski.
It's a pleasure to join you this morning, Beth.
You know, we were just talking to Marvin Schechter. I know you know Mr. Schechter. He gave us an overview of the state of forensic testing around the country and the efforts to get validation and sort of standardized testing. And now I really welcome the opportunity to get a scientist's perspective. Mm-hmm. He mentioned early on in the interview something that you and I discussed last night when we were talking about getting ready for today's show, which is how prosecutors will present testimony from an expert, a scientist, maybe a medical doctor, and elicit from them an opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty or medical certainty. And Mr. Schechter used the term as an acceptable term. I didn't challenge him on it, but I want to ask you, what does that mean as a scientist?
Actually, it's a very good question because that term has become really state of art for a scientist in the courtroom. In fact, I think attorneys that do their questioning of their expert, bring it home at the very end of the testimony. They basically put it to their expert, can you state to a reasonable degree of scientific or medical certainty that, your opinion is such and such? And the fact of the matter is that it probably makes sense in a legal context, but it certainly makes no sense in a scientific context. Perhaps, everybody seems to be aware of the National Research Council report, Strengthening Forensic Science in the United States, and now there is a National Commission on Forensic Science attempting to address the issues raised in that report and increase the bar, raise standards for all of forensic science testing. Part of this involves committee work. One of the committees is looking at that term, reasonable scientific certainty, and they are going to be making a recommendation that that term be dropped altogether from testimony. And the reason is that there really is no scientific basis for it. You don't offer a scientific opinion in a professional setting. You're publishing an article for a chemistry journal, for example. You don't end it off by saying, I have found X, Y, and Z to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. It makes no sense from a scientific basis. Science is quantitative. The scientific method is employed. But in no way, shape, or form does a scientist use that terminology, reasonable degree of scientific certainty. And the problem is that juries can be misled. They can be influenced by that term and pay very close attention to whatever that expert said, whether they understand what the expert said or not. And so the recommendation is going to be to remove that phrase from the lexicon of people testifying in a courtroom, scientists that are testifying. Now, that is going to be at the federal level, but there's no doubt in my mind that the states will follow up and remove that phrase from the lexicon.
Well, that's interesting that you feel there's no doubt the states will follow up and remove it, because Mr. Schechter says states are very, very slow, reluctant to make changes based upon the 2009 report. Now, I know the changes are more than what you're suggesting, but he said they're reluctant. Prosecutors, really did not receive the report well. Why do you think that prosecutors across the country will drop the question about reasonable degree of scientific or medical certainty?
You know, prosecutors like the status quo, and I think that the National Commission on Forensic Science is trying to level the playing field and make it more fair for everybody concerned. And that involves all kinds of issues, like discovery being done in a timely fashion. I guess, you know, many people realize that discovery has to be done reciprocally, that, you know, prosecutors have to reveal important information to defense attorneys and vice versa. That's part of the routine, but often prosecutors don't hand this stuff over to the defense until almost the very last minute, kind of like a sandbag effect in a sense. Well, the National Commission is going to try to change that, changing the way discovery is provided, changing the way terminology is provided. They're going to be looking at all kinds of areas. They've developed these scientific area committees, and they're going to be investigating all kinds of evidence, whether it's digital, multimedia, biological, DNA, chemical, instrumental analysis, physics, pattern evidence, crime scene investigation, death investigation. All of that is going to be dramatically changed. The standards will be changed in an effort to make a more level playing field for all concerned.
I'm Beth Karras, filling in for Dan Hochheiser on Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser. We're talking to Dr. Lawrence Kobylinski, a forensic scientist. He is a regular guest on radio and television. He shares his expertise, but he's a very busy man as professor of forensic science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and chair of its Department of Sciences. So one thing also that Mr. Schechter brought up, and I'd like to get from you how to address this, is bias in the interpretation of results on the part of an expert, on the part of a scientist, a criminalist. How do you deal with one's subjectivity, bias, in interpreting evidence?
Oh, my goodness, that's a very good question. I think that, you know, bias is a problem, obviously. We have to make every effort to get rid of bias, but sometimes there's deliberate, you know, it's conscious, and sometimes it's unconscious. I think one of the thoughts of the National Research Council is to take experts that typically work in crime labs and get them away from law enforcement. In other words, the logic is that if you are a scientist and you work in a crime lab, and that crime lab is part of law enforcement, there are going to be pressures, whether they're subtle or whether they're not so subtle, but, you know, there is a lot of pressure in this system. A lot of law enforcement wants to get the bad guys off the street, and they will deliberately or not deliberately put pressure on experts to come up with helpful information. So it's really important that the expert render an opinion that is based on a scientific foundation and not for one side or the other. You see, the problem, Beth, is that forensic scientists are caught in this adversarial system. You're either working for a prosecutorial agency, law enforcement, or you're working for the defense and you're getting paid for your time. So there is a tendency to provide information that's helpful to one side or the other. And this is exactly what we have to do away with. We have to try to eliminate the bias. There have been many ethical issues that have occurred over the years. And part of it is blamed on a bias on the part of the expert. Giving an opinion that is more favorable to one side than the other, not because of the science, but because of the pressures. Sometimes scientists will not reveal all the information that they should be revealing. So this is a major issue. I'm glad you brought it up because I think this is one of the areas that we try to push as much as we can while training forensic scientists. Ethics, we teach ethics across the curriculum. No matter what the discipline, whether it's chemical, biological, or physical, we always try to tell people have a scientific foundation. And that's really where we're going with the National Commission on Forensic Science. Ballistics is a big question. Bite mark is a big question. All pattern evidence is a problem because currently it's not based upon a solid scientific foundation, but rather based upon one's knowledge and skills and experience and training. That's not enough. Forensic science in the courtroom must be based on a scientific foundation, and that is where the National Commission is making its efforts the strongest.
You know, there was an arson case that was in the news, and people continue to talk about a death case where Cameron Todd Willingham in Texas was executed. It was an arson, and his daughters died. And he always said he didn't do it, and many believe he is indeed innocent. And it was the erroneous interpretation of the fire that led to his conviction and his execution. Is arson interpretation one of these areas under attack?
Well, actually, I must say that all areas of forensic are under some level of attack. John Lentini did that case that you're referring to, and he did reveal that there were errors in the investigation. The attack is across the board, no matter what the field is, because we have a tendency, experts get on the stand and they testify about their many years of experience, knowledge, and training, and they are permitted to render an opinion. The problem is that often their opinion is partially based on science and partially their own experience. This is very typical in pathology. When a medical examiner gets up and explains manner of death, cause of death, it's based upon their knowledge and experience and training. But on the
Which
other hand,
it counts for something. I mean, that's important.
It's very important, and it does count for something. And I would say that that is true for a number of areas. However, when it comes to things like bite mark or odontology evidence or other kinds of pattern evidence like ballistics, where you really have the expert's word as to, for example, if you're a ballistics expert and you're looking at evidence, you're looking at shell casings or bullets, and you're looking at striations and scratches and marks, and you're comparing a known to an unknown, you're basically saying that because I'm so experienced, because I know so much about doing ballistics, I've done it for 30 years, I know it when I see it, and I'm saying that to a degree of scientific certainty, this gun fired that bullet. Well, that's fine for now, but it's not enough for the future. Because what they're going to have to do is take this evidence, study it in a quantitative way, develop information, for example, what is the probability of error in the interpretation. They're going to have quantitative analysis of the evidence, and they're going to have to express their final conclusion in a different way. You can't just say, I'm knowledgeable, I'm experienced, this is what I think, and you have to believe it. There's no other choice. That's not the way it's going to be done in the future. There's going to be a lot of research done in all of these areas, especially in bite mark evidence, which is probably one type of evidence that has been under the most attack. And I have friends who are board-certified forensic odontologists that swear that their work is 100% accurate, But actually, I'll tell you something, Beth. I've been to court, and I've listened to an odontologist. I was involved in a case in Nassau County.
Well, let me tell you, you know what? We've just run out of time, Dr. Kobylinski. I am so sorry, because I'd love to hear that. But I will talk to you off-air about it. I want to thank you so much for your time and sharing your insights, because it's always so enlightening to talk to you. And I'll be looking for these changes, as we all should. Coming up, the answer to the question of the day, what percentage of wrongful convictions are a result, at least in part, of faulty forensics? 23%, 47%, or 72%?
Hockeiser & Hockeiser LLP is a highly experienced criminal defense firm that is dedicated to providing the residents of New York City with the aggressive representation that they deserve. With more than a half century of experience combined, both Lawrence and Daniel Hockeiser are well equipped to handle the most difficult of criminal cases. They also represent clients in both state and federal courts. You can rest assured that your case is in good hands when you enlist the help of the firm. For more information, contact Hockeiser & Hockeiser at Hockeiser.com, HOCHHEISER.com, or 212-689-4343. 212-689-4343.
And so the answer to today's question, what percentage of wrongful convictions are a result, at least in part, of faulty forensics? 47%. Of the first 325 exonerations tracked by responsible, by the Innocence Project, they're responsible for them, 47% had faulty forensics as a contributing cause. A wrongful conviction can have more than one cause. In fact, of those first 325 exonerations, 72% of the wrongful convictions were because of mistaken identification. Yes, eyewitness identification is the most problematic. So what needs to be done about forensics? Well, you've heard two of the experts briefly discuss the issues. States need to step up, make sure their labs are accredited, perhaps using a nationwide standard. Judges need to learn to distinguish between reliable and unreliable scientific evidence. Analysts, criminalists, the experts who testify every day in courtrooms around the country need to be trained and certified and retrained and recertified. It's continuing education for all participants in the process to make sure that our ultimate goal is met, and that is to protect society from the guilty among us and to ensure that no innocent person is wrongfully convicted. A big thank you to Marvin Schechter and Dr. Lawrence Kobylinski for sharing their thoughts about forensics in the courtroom. Next week's guest on Talkin' Law with Dan Hockeiser is Dennis Hoff, owner of the Bunny Ranch in Nevada. And on April 29th, former Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts will join Dan Hockeiser. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Beth Karras. Join my website, karrasoncrime.com, for in-depth coverage of some of the hottest legal stories. Take care, everyone.